Hello.
Hi, I'm Laura Tamedia. I'm the alcohol epidemiologist in New Mexico, and I'm going to talk a little bit about a project that actually I didn't start. My predecessor, Jim Rober, started it, and then I got to finish it, which is the best kind of project. Someone else do the hard work. So Bob and Daphne talked a lot about this, and Naomi talked about it as well, but I wanted to give you just a little bit of, you know, in New Mexico, we talked about this, you know, 88,000 deaths per year. In New Mexico, that's about an average of 4 deaths per day in our very small population. When we look at, the alcohol tends to hit folks, especially in working, I'm a little bit younger than, for example, tobacco, and so about 1 in 6 deaths are among working, or 1 in 6 deaths among working age adults are due to alcohol. Bob talked about how it's very expensive for the nation, but just to bring it down a little bit to our little local level, that was about 2.2, in that same study, it was about $2.2 billion for New Mexico. That's a lot of money for us. We're a very poor state. And I would venture to say that that was actually a very conservative estimate of the cost of excessive alcohol in our state. I'm going to just kind of slide through this one since I think you guys have a pretty good picture of binge drinking now. So binge drinking, it's bad. Don't do it. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about an intervention that I think doesn't have a super strong evidence base behind it yet, called over-service enforcement. So in most states in the nation, it is illegal to serve to someone who is already intoxicated. And it varies a little bit state by state and jurisdiction by jurisdiction and locality by locality and tribal nation to tribal nation. But in New Mexico, for example, it's illegal to serve to someone who's already visibly drunk. So the bars do have a little bit of an out there, and then if the person isn't visibly drunk, then they can get off. But they can be cited for this. And in New Mexico, they, it can actually be fairly serious, where you, the bar or the server can both get a ticket. And in New Mexico, if you get 3 citations as a bar, you can actually lose your license. And as Naomi said, in New Mexico, these licenses are private property and on the open market sell for sometimes over almost $1 million. So that's a pretty big loss financially. So it has the potential to be a really good incentive to not serve people who are already drunk and to, you know, I guess cut them off is the colloquialism. However, this isn't a very commonly used intervention. So, for example, only 20% of local jurisdictions and about 60% of state agencies, so these are enforcement agencies, reported conducting enforcement efforts in the past year in a survey of law enforcement agencies. And less than 50% of these agencies actually use these strategies regularly. The Community Preventive Services Task Force did a review of all of the studies looking at increased enforcement initiatives in 2010. They found 2 studies, but they were really promising. However, there were only 2. So I apologize. I'm having a brain. I wrote this myself. Michigan. Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize. If you want, you can call New Mexico, New Hampshire, or something like that. Anyway, Michigan did have a study. They did an evaluation of an increase in refusals to serve to pseudo-intoxicated. They found that when they increased enforcement and then they sent in people who were pretending to be drunk, that they found a significant decrease. They also found a decrease in DWI arrests after the increase in enforcement. And then also in Washington, I do know WA, an evaluation of an intervention in Washington found no change in license practices, so they didn't really see a lot of differences in how licensees behaved, but they did find a decrease in DWI arrests and also in average BAC levels among DWI arrestees, so which we hope means that they were drinking less. But the community guide was published with an insufficient evidence recommendation. So the task force had decided that there wasn't enough evidence to really make a recommendation at this point. Okay. So that brings us to the situation in New Mexico. So in New Mexico in 2006, we enacted a comprehensive DWI initiative. I really want to stress, because this is a major limitation of this paper, is that this was a pretty comprehensive initiative. It included a number of evidence-based strategies. But part of it was increasing enforcement of this regulation that I talked about, prohibiting over-service to licensed locations, in licensed locations throughout the state. So bars, clubs, restaurants, basically on-premise locations that are regulated. We did find that during that time period, the number of citations increased from about 55 citations to about 203 citations. So while this is super exciting, I do want to take a second to put this in context, in that last year we had 11 citations. So this is a great initiative, but I want to write a second follow-up paper on how it has not continued. But anyway, so our objective was basically to evaluate, did this work? Was this increased enforcement effective? And so I'll go into methods in just a second. So we used the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. It's the largest continuously conducted health survey system in the world. It's a random digit dial. And it's been very helpful to us at the state level and to some extent at the local level for providing kind of our base estimates for public health, like health conditions and chronic disease behaviors. We were able to ask what's called the binge drinking module and two, both in a before and after. So several years before this happened and then also several years after. And the binge drinking module allows us to actually calculate binge drinking intensity. So it asks among binge drinkers, it asks them, on your last binge drinking occasion, how many drinks of wine did you have? How many drinks of beer did you have? How many drinks of distilled spirits did you have? And then it actually goes even further than that. I think it asks about malt liquor now or something. And then we can add all of those up to figure out the number of drinks consumed on the last binge drinking location. And it also, episode, and also asks about location. One thing that I do want to mention is that, unfortunately, I don't rule the world. And the definition of binge drinking changed right in the middle of our study period. So that was unfortunate. So even though, as Daphne said, the definition of excessive binge drinking now is 4 or more drinks for a woman on a single occasion or 5 or more drinks on a single occasion for men, before, in our pre-time period, it was 5 for both. And so what we ended up having to do was exclude all women who reported that they drank exactly 4 drinks from the binge drinking definition. We categorized licensed locations. Their last binge episode into licensed locations and unlicensed locations. And then we calculated the odds of consuming 8 or more drinks on a binge drinking occasion. And then we adjusted the odds for a lot of sociodemographic factors that we felt like could be having potential confounding. We also decided to stratify by age and gender, just to kind of take a look a little bit at where the change was happening. And then hopefully we adjusted for complex survey design. It's kind of an EPI 101 thing. And then after the exclusions, we had almost 1,000 respondents in our pre-time period and about 800 respondents in our post. And then comparing the two time periods, the average number of binge drinks consumed, it decreased, which was good. So from about an average of 8.2 drinks to about 7.2 drinks. And then the average number of drinks consumed by binge drinkers in unlicensed locations really didn't change. So if we look at the this table here is if we look at licensed locations and we look at unlicensed locations, and we can look at the actual percent of binge drinkers who drank 8 or more drinks in licensed locations and then unlicensed locations. I forgot that in my instructions as a presenter, I'm supposed to use the mouse to point to things. There we go. Okay. So, and then in our post-time period, you can see that we saw a pretty stark reduction in the folks who were binge drinking in licensed locations. So we saw a 43% reduction in the percent of binge drinkers who were consuming 8 or more drinks, so kind of a high-intensity binge drinking. And then after we adjusted for all those sociodemographic factors that we talked about, We found that there was a significant reduction between the two time periods. And I think kind of importantly, if we look at unlicensed locations, like I said, this intervention included a lot of different components. So, but this is one of the few components that was specifically in bars and clubs and restaurants. So I think it provides us with a little bit of extra information that there was no change in sort of this high-intensity drinking among binge drinkers in unlicensed locations. And if you can see among, we saw both the change, we saw this decrease both in women and also in men. However, in men it was slightly larger decrease. And where we did see a difference was in age. So if you look at these younger folks, 18 to 34, we saw a really large percent decrease in that age group, whereas in the over 35 age group, the percent change was a slightly smaller and actually wasn't significant once we adjusted for other factors. So we concluded that enhanced enforcement of New Mexico's over-service laws was associated with a nearly 50% reduction in this sort of high-intensity binge drinking among binge drinkers in bars and clubs. And that, they seem to really be a little bit more among men and among younger age groups. And these are groups that are actually also at high risk for binge drinking. So this is kind of, good news. And then these declines occurred in the absence of similar declines in unlicensed locations. So, like all of our studies, I also have limitations. So it was a repeat cross-sectional study. We did have a little bit of the intervention. Again, I don't rule the world, so I can't sort of make law enforcement do the intervention when I tell them to do it. So it actually continued a little bit into 2007, which was sort of what we're considering our post-intervention time period. This was specific to New Mexico, so I can't necessarily say that what worked in New Mexico would work in other states, but it does kind of provide a little bit more information. Oops, there we go. The CDC pays me, and I appreciate that. And I really want to thank Jim Rober because I want to thank everybody on this list. So some folks from Boston University were super helpful at getting me to finish this project because, as I'm sure you all know, we tend to have a million things on our to-do lists. And so they really helped me, provided some consultation, and I want to thank Bob and Daphna and also Jim Rober for starting this project. Thank you. I have 5 minutes for questions. Scott? Go ahead.
So my question is just about, was there any information collected on revenue? And I guess I'm curious as to kind of the business model or model might have to sort of, if you could basically say that there was no major impact on revenue, that this is much more likely. But I could also see arguments of business teams coming in and saying, well, we've reduced the number of trips, reducing our revenue.
Yeah, I would love to get local revenue data. Unfortunately, the revenue data that we get right now is wholesaler data, and we can only get that right now at the state level. There is sort of a county variable, but when I kind of dug deeply into it and talked to folks, that county variable is it's just sort of where the wholesaler's address is and not where the alcohol is actually being sold. We have looked into maybe using sales data and to get maybe a little bit more tax data for sales tax data, which we might be able to get a little bit more at a local level. I mean, I think that there is, I think it's good to sort of consider the economic aspect of it, but it is kind of a tricky situation to get into because, unfortunately when people binge drink and they drink more, then that is, money that the bar makes off of someone who is already drunk. and I mean, I think that there's a certain amount of ethics to be involved in that for sure. And I don't know if I answered your question, but unfortunately the short answer is no, I don't have that data.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we could look at sort of what licensees went out of business during that time period. As far as I know, none of them did. There were a couple who had their licenses removed because they sold to three or more. You know, I mean, they were warned repeatedly and then sold. Yeah, no, I know. Yeah. And then I saw a question here, and then Bob. Yeah, I didn't, but Jim Rober did, and I didn't include that graph in here, but just to, for simplicity's sake, but there was kind of, you know, sharper, so DWI has been declining in New Mexico. It's kind of plateaued in the last couple of years, which is way after this time period, but he did find a slightly sharper decline, like right after that intervention time period. The DWI data, though, like if you remember, it while it did more sort of more sharply decline, this intervention really did include a lot of things like saturation checkpoints, a huge mass media campaign. They had a DWI czar that started. Hopefully, I'm not misspeaking. Mike was there during this time period. I wasn't at the DOH during this time period, so. So the DWI data, I would, you know, I think it's good to also have that sort of reduction in harm, but as far as tying it directly to this intervention, I think that's where it gets a little squishier because all of those interventions were towards reducing DWI and not necessarily reducing binge drinking in bars.
Bob, I just want to make a quick response to Scott's question. I know we're just about out of time, and I'm going to cut into my own time if I talk too much. So, but I mean, I think it, which maybe would be a good thing. Anyway, no, Scott, I mean, it's a very good question, but I do think there's a broader context here, which is we've got a huge societal cost related to excessive drinking. This is one of the tools potentially in our toolbox to reduce that societal cost. Are there going to be implications for the revenue that alcohol retailers are going to appreciate as a result of stricter enforcement of laws, increasing alcohol taxes? There will be. There will be. I mean, we estimate that 50% of the per capita alcohol sales in this country are consumed in the form of binge drinks. So if we're successful in reducing binge drinking, we're going to cut sales in half. That may be why some people in the industry aren't terribly happy about some of these interventions. But I think with respect to over-service enforcement, it's important to keep in mind that basically what we're talking about is, shall we say, helping these retailers to obey the law. So to the extent that they're appreciating a reduction in sales as a result of this, it's because they're coming into compliance with the law. So I think you could say that any revenue they've been generating as a result of illegal alcohol sales, they shouldn't be getting in the first place. So, and I know you agree. I'm not. Don't need to convince you of that. But I think there is a broader context here that's important. So, thanks.
So I am out of time, but I will. I'm sticking for the whole alcohol surveillance section. So if you want to ask afterwards, I will be here. Thank you so much.